Greetings to all listeners, living and dead, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the Night's Watch of Pop Culture, where we forsake the ways of men in order to keep an eye on what's happening in the worlds of music, TV, film, books, and necromancy. I'm Andrew Harrison, and as you can probably tell, it's a special edition this week. We will be devoting the bulk of the show to the Game of Thrones finale. Who lived? Who died? Who is paying the gas bill for all that dragon fire? And should Daenerys Targaryen consider changing her energy supplier? Moreover, how did the penultimate season of TV's live-action Dungeons & Dragons shape up? Beware, spoilers are coming, so if you haven't seen this week's finale yet, please scroll forward to later in the show, when in a dramatic change of context, we'll be looking at the comeback album from LCD Sound System. Where did James Murphy's Fall and public image-inspired post-dance project fit in, 10 years on from the New York hipster scene that birthed it? And having admitted to losing his edge to brighter, younger, better-looking 20-somethings last time around, will we now hear about how he's losing his edge to brighter, smarter 40-year-olds? And the Big Mouth Citadel is crowded today as we have three confirmed throne heads joining us. Jamie East is a long-time co-presenter of Sky Atlantic's Thronecast, as well as a Virgin Radio DJ. In past lives, he's been Mr. Holy Moly, the much-missed gossip website, and lead singer up with The Beekeepers. Darby's answer to the question, are there any bands from Derby? Hello, Jamie. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you?
The correct answer to that is antipasti.
Antipasti? Yeah.
Brew your own. Yeah. It's about to ferment.
Yeah. There you go. Now, in the course of this season, you kept telling me on Facebook and places like that, you're not going to believe it. What's going to happen? How far ahead were you in seeing this? You know, had you seen it all the way, the finale, by like episode 3?
It's a weird one. When I first started, HBO was very relaxed. It was kind of like we'd get the vast majority of the whole season before we started filming or before it aired.
Yeah.
Because of the leaks and because of the size of the show that it is now, it's very, very tight. So what you get is you get given synopsis of the series, which is basically one paragraph. So you get 10 paragraphs if it was a 10 episode. For this one, we got 7 paragraphs.
Right.
And it just said stuff like, there was like 2 sentences per episode of the main events. And that's all we got.
We saw
the episodes maybe 2 or 3 days before, just so you could kind of prep the show and kind of work out. And also, if I'm interviewing someone, then you've got to know really why you're interviewing them. If all of a sudden you're interviewing someone about Littlefinger, then you've got a hunch as to why you're interviewing someone about Littlefinger.
Yeah, because I remember like early on you were saying, you know, I think it's going to end, you know, it might end with the wall coming down. Who knows?
Oh, did I say that?
Were you fully aware that this was going to happen?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, okay. So you do, you know,
I think any twat, you know that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, we know
any this, chance to brag.
This we know, yes, it is known. What we're doing all the kind of, you know, the on-the-spot reports and the behind-the-scenes stuff, what's been, for this go-round, what's been your personal highlight
of the
stuff you've got to do that we don't get to do?
I visited the set, which we've been trying to do for such a long time, and trying to get over to Belfast, and you know, quite rightly they run a very tight ship over there, but we finally got there, and it was just mind-blowing.
Did you nick anything?
Do you know what, I was there, I got left alone in the props warehouse with, and there were 3 replica, or the actual one of them was the actual one, the Shireen Baratheon's scorched stag,
burnt little stag, yes,
that Davos found in the ashes, which led to kind of Melisandre's kind of, there was one of those, and I thought, come on, she's dead, she's, they never
never gonna need this.
She won't miss it.
I came quite close to them, and I thought, actually, I've still got one season to do.
Yeah.
There's bound to be cameras here.
That could have been a Littlefinger test, couldn't it?
It could have been.
Nick it.
Yeah,
really nick it.
Well, I passed the test, HBO.
Shame of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been.
So we won't be slitting your throat today, possibly later. Also with us, she did the kind of launch episode for this season's Game of Thrones, and now she's back for the recap. It's Anna Fielding. Now in your new job as associate editor brackets features close brackets at Stylish magazine, she's coming back to cap it off like Arya Stark. Anna is ex of Rave, Bible, Mixmag, and the weekly guide to whatever's going on from the modern lady about town, Emerald Street. Hello, Anna. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How
are
you
Andrew.
Doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Now, speaking on behalf of all women everywhere, Game of Thrones.
I feel comfortable and happy in this position. Yes,
you can totally do that. Did Game of Thrones properly open up the fantasy genre to like a wider female audience that hadn't had it before? Is that just a kind of is that an illusion?
I think it's probably a bit of an illusion. I think that there are large communities of women who are quite involved in fantasy and comic books and action films and so on. I think it's probably just that, like, as it did with everyone, it opened up a fantasy genre to a lot of people who were not necessarily in it, but the whole thing of saying, well, it's not really about wizards, it's more about politics. And I think that's probably appealed to as many non-fantasy women as non-fantasy men.
Non-fantasy women. The best kind of women.
I am speaking for all women.
you're a fantasy woman.
Thanks.
How throny are stylist readers then? I mean, do they have particular areas of the show that they...
I would say it's huge, yeah. I mean, if you look at the stats on our website, every time we put a Game of Thrones story up, it zooms off. It's been consistently the best thing online for stylist for the last couple of months while it's been airing.
The perpetual argument that keeps coming back with Game of Thrones is that, well, does it treat the female characters, are they the female characters strong enough, or are they just artifacts to be moved around on the chessboard? I think this season proved very, very clearly that they aren't. How do your readers have they taken to that debate?
I think very well, actually, because I think especially in the first series, you know, there's all the boobs and the sex position, and now Cersei's walking around in high neck black dresses looking like she's been dressed by the Antwerp Six, so it's...
Yeah.
But you've seen, obviously, so many of the female characters really rise in power and status, and also, actually, in terms of sheer manipulation and cruelty, I don't think there's any kind of... We've got two queens vying for the throne now rather than a king. I mean, yeah. Jon is going to be subservient to either... queen, but
we'll see about that.
Maybe.
You know what? When I watched the TV finale the other day, and I remember doing this show with you before, I thought you bloody knew that about the wall coming down as I was watching it.
Sorry.
Also with us, doing double duty on Big Mouth and our sister podcast, Romaniacs, all the best Brexit analysis, romaniacs.com viewers. It's the politically minded Lord Peter Baelish of Big Mouth, Dorian Linsky. Hello, how are you?
Hi, Andrew, I'm all right. Surviving. Like him.
Yes, Dorian writes for The Guardian, Q and Empire. He's the author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, The History of Process Songs, which equips him well for both Brexit and Game of Thrones. Now, we tried to do a bit of if Brexit was Game of Thrones, but on Romaniacs, didn't we? And it's arm and legs. The conclusion was that Brexit is the army of the dead advancing while everybody bickers. Possibly Nigel Farage's Joffrey, happy to ruin everything for a laugh, and Theresa May's Burley Tommen. That's a push. Are we badly in need of a Jon Snow or a Tyrion Lannister to sort this shit out?
Well, the comedian Rob Delaney was saying that, there should be a ban on political analogies, Game of Thrones analogies. But I think there should be more relentless and constant.
Endless.
Because we've got a new trove of references. And there's something, it's like a genuinely massive pop record where there's a joy in the fact that everybody in inverted commas, knows it.
Yeah.
And it's like... You know, for years it was like, okay, you can make a reference to Star Wars. Oh, that's that person. That's a bit Yoda. That person's like Yoda. Or Lord of the Rings when the movies came out. Not before. I had no idea what was going on before the movies came out.
Yeah.
Then Harry Potter, again to like kids, no idea what references people were making. But, you know, I loved the fact that everybody had those. And now the fact that Game of Thrones feels like a massive shared conversation.
It's unlike a gigantic metaphor.
Unlike any of the other TV shows I watch. And because it's got these sort of political resonances, or just resonances that you can make up for your own amusement, there's just this sort of new shorthand. And I'm sure it will get old. Maybe it already has got old and I haven't noticed. But I find you can explain pretty much anything with reference to
Game of Thrones. Also with us, giving sound counsel and ensuring we don't have any wild ideas, our producer, there's Sir Davos Seaworth of podcasts, Matt Hall. He's got all his own fingers there. Hello, Matt, how are you?
You just blow my gag about, you know, how difficult it is to operate this mixing desk with three fingers.
Right, does it with his elbows. Before we get on to Game of Thrones, we talked about Marvel's Defenders on last week's show, and I finally finished this week, and I'm going to knock it down a place in the standings. I thought it was massively disappointing in the final analysis.
Too many pop culture references.
What? There's not enough.
No, I mean this show.
This show. It's a pop culture show. It's about pop culture. Too much Brexit on Romaniacs. Okay, before we get started, we'll just have a quick reminder to our dear listeners. If you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts on the podcast app or in the iTunes Music Store? And while you're there, why not give us a lovely review and a star rating as well? It all helps us to win more listeners and we would be very grateful. Android people, remember, you can get us on Stitcher and Audio Boom too, as well as Spotify. Okay, so let's get cracking on with the actual Game of Thrones finale. Season 7 set an eventful new pace for the show. It's overtaken the books, as everyone knows. George R. R. Martin has sketched out the plot and let the showrunners get on with it, which was divisive for a lot of viewers. We're going to talk about the season as a whole and our guesses for 2018's final episodes later in the show, but first the finale. And to get you in the mood, from Ramin Djawadi's soundtrack, here is The Army of the Dead. and now our watch is ended until 2019 or something when it comes back. That was The Army of the Dead from Game of Thrones Season 7 soundtrack. All right, that finale. Did it hit our expectations? It was quite odd to see the show end with basically a PowerPoint presentation in the Dragon Den, wasn't it? Anna, what did you make of the finale?
I thoroughly enjoyed it, although I thought it was flawed. I think I enjoyed it on a level of spectacle and kind of narrative satisfaction. I think that bit in the dragon pit of seeing all the sort of pairings that you've got so used to them walking for miles and miles around Westeros and having time to talk to each other, to sort of see them all come together and see the looks and the relationships and things, that sort of tapestry of relationships that was taking place in that. But then, you know, I mentioned that people seemed to spend episode after episode just trudging through flat bits of Westeros talking to each other. That's all gone now. And it feels that these are very high octane bits and a lot of kind of satisfying narrative bits, but it doesn't feel quite perhaps as fleshed out as it has done. Like when you see Lord Baelish and he's dragged into his trial and he believes it to be a trial for Arya, you know, is that because reference to future LCD sound system thing? Has Baelish lost his edge? Or that was really crowhorned.
Younger and sharper people with no faces.
With no faces. And I hear you and your band sold your swords.
I'd love to hear him do that with his peculiar bespoke accent.
I hear you and your band. But I just wonder if it was the Baelish of old who had fingers in all old pies and knew everything and was kind of the first person to really push the domino that set off the whole storyline. Wouldn't he have known they're confined to a relatively small castle as castles go?
But I thought that was the great thing about it, because he's destroyed by his own overreach and he's killed by basically the weapons that he's built. He set up all those betrayals and the dominoes fell on him.
I know, which is why it was great and it was really narratively satisfying. Yeah. But in terms of his character, wouldn't he have known? I don't know.
But also it was really good to see how he was thrown all the way through the series whenever... the three-eyed raven just kind of dropped an intimation that he knew everything.
Chaos is allowed.
You could see just like...
Yeah. The Bran is now basically Google, isn't he? Bran is taking all the fun out of everything and just very quickly discover the truth.
Although, yes. The only thing that drove me mad, because I've got an opinion on what you'd said, but the thing that drove me mad, how did Samwell tell Bran that the marriage had been annulled? That was the bit where I was like... He was like, he knows everything. He was like, their marriage has been annulled. He's like, wait, what?
Well, you can't know. The thing doesn't make sense that you can know everything. You can have access to everything, like Google.
Yeah.
But then you need somebody to maybe pop up and go, look over there. And I like the way he goes, really? Hang on a minute. Yeah. And he pops back and he goes, oh yeah, you're right.
Because otherwise,
you would, I mean, your mind would explode if you were aware of everything that had ever happened. All at once.
It's the Matrix.
It's actually Dr. Manhattan. Yeah. He's the Dr. Manhattan of Game of Thrones, able to see past, future, but unable to move anybody. Or is he? I don't know. Can he change things? We don't know, do we? We're going to discover this.
There was an inkling that he could. Do you remember when he first went to the Tower of Joy and Ned Stark turned around as he was going up the stairs because he thought he heard something? I think there's a little bit of that, a little bit of Patrick Strazy trying to knock the book off the shelf in Ghost kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't like pretentious gap year Bran at all.
See, I actually...
And he's just like, you should check out the doors. They've got
amazing stuff, guys.
Yeah. I saw there's some great weed beyond the wall. Yeah. But they're really like, they're very nice. They don't have much money, but they're really just nice people. Like, there's just something insufferable. Unfortunately, I think, you know, puberty has done bad things to the actor's face and just given him a kind of... Just an insufferably pretentious face. Yeah. And he just kind of slopes around going, I know everything, but not really helping.
Well, I'm going to go totally against that because I actually really like what's happened to Bran. I was bored with Bran being dragged around by better and more interesting characters, none of whom I could really understand why they were doing it. Can I think of this kid, take me on trust, I'm the three-eyed raven. Now he actually he's kind of ascended to this realm of pure omniscience. And with that goes a certain powerlessness. You're just watching it all happen unfold. And I actually find him a more interesting character. He's one of the characters that this season I think became, to my taste anyway, more interesting. Overall, Dory, what did you make of the finale episode?
Well, I'm not really on the whole kind of Game of Thrones has jumped the shark thing because I almost feel like maybe I feel some people saying that are perhaps overrating, you know, its sort of authenticity and precision in the past. And now suddenly everybody's just like, but how fast do ravens fly? And it's like, really? Like, you think up to this point, it was just like sort of cinema verite. And everything was just like, just everything kind of adds up. And now it's got silly. And I didn't understand that at all. But what I did feel, is a bit like Anna was saying, was that there was a series where it was too slow, and now it's too fast. I mean, it's fine. So it's very exciting, but there's these like huge moments. And actually, my favourite bit, my least favourite bit, was the wall falling. Because that was definitely the bit where those people are going, I don't really watch, you know, fantasy shows. And you're going, no, no, it's really like politics. It's like kind of, you know, it's all like Wolf Hall. And then they go, here's a kind of, it's like naff-looking dragon with a guy bouncing up and down on the back, just burning a CGI wall. And you go, right, no, that bit's not so much about politics. Yeah. Whereas the actual, the ideas, you know, the ideas about power and this brilliant idea about the kind of the performance aspect of leadership, which Jon Snow does not understand at all, and thinks that it's all about principle. And in fact, everybody told him, like, you're an idiot. Why don't you just lie? Why don't you just, you know, think of the optics?
I can't do that.
Yeah. I can't. Because, you know, my dad wouldn't. And it's like, that's why your dad lost his head. Yeah. Like, that was a teachable moment when your dad told the truth and got his head knocked. Yeah. You know, so the kind of, all those ideas about, you know, would Daenerys, you know, be a good ruler? What makes a good ruler? What responsibility do you have to the rule? How do you play the Game of Thrones? I loved all of that. And the fact that there was room for it, perhaps because it was feature length, and there was room for, you know, a lot of character work and a lot of conversation, which in this series there hasn't been that much. There's a lot of kind of quick, oh, fancy seeing you here, Bants, en route to some conflagration.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I think those grounded things are still there, and I think the ideas are there, and I don't really care about. I suppose I don't care about the breaches of, in scare quotes,
logic.
Realism.
Yeah.
But I wonder, do the writers care? I suppose that's the thing. It's like, if you think, if the writers are just like, I just imagine them writing this whiteboard with all the details about how the world worked, and then for this season, someone just went, wiped it off and went, nobody cares, nerds.
Yeah.
Zombie dragon, you know, and that worried me slightly going forward.
Yeah. Do we think that, I mean, we've watched six seasons where it's all driven by character, but inevitably events are now taking over. We are reaching a crescendo whether we like it or not. So you're not going to get, I mean, my favourite part of this entire season was Tormund and the Hound yomping and just getting on each other's nerves. Yeah. And you're fucking idiot, why are you not dead? Ha ha, yes, I've got a wonderful 7 foot tall blonde bird back home. No, you haven't. That I could watch that. I could have watched a whole episode, or in fact a spin-off. I want there to be a spin-off called Whatever Happened to the Westeros Lads, in which those two just wander around getting on each other's nerves. Those are the things that really made it work. And also in the actual finale itself, just, is it all about cocks in the end? You know, which I thought was great. It just kind of, the motivations behind it all. But is it a case that you've got the kind of the gravity of genre, which says ultimately this is sword and sorcery, so you need a bloody big dragon?
This is I always find it really, really interesting when like we've been talking about, where it's like where the way that all of us have sold it to non people who watch Game of Thrones is that it's not about dragons and wizards. It is about that is the whole thing. George R. R. Martin did not write it to be a satire against British politics. He wrote it because he'd written many, many books before about dragons and swords and destiny and all the rest of it. The hard fact of the matter is that people did moan a fuck of a lot about Game of Thrones throughout the past four or five series, about it moving too slow and nothing happening. Now, realistically, there are 15 actors on a lot of money whose contracts expire in about 2 years. There are showrunners that have been working on this show for Christ knows how long, who are desperate to actually do something else. And also, with the ending, with the wall coming down, that is the only thing that could have happened, because at some point, the White Walkers and the undead had to get across the wall.
Point of logic, by the way, the blue stuff that comes out of the ice dragon, it's clearly antifreeze, isn't it? Because that's what makes
it stinks.
Yeah, really pongy. But I bet if you have a bit of a nip of it, you really, you know, have a very busy weekend. No, I agree. It's got to be true to itself.
So I always imagine like you know, Daniel and David, kind of when they hear people going, "Oh, it's not just about it's not just tits and dragons." It's like, kind of actually, it is actually. You know, the rest of it was just a happy written accident. Because you know, I've met George R. R. Martin. And he does like his tits and his dragons.
I want to talk about three particular bits. We touched on one of them earlier, the death of Littlefinger and Sansa kind of coming into her own. Was this Sansa's like ascension moment, where she's all the lessons she's been slowly, painfully, patiently learning, she finally puts them into action?
I think so, and I think it was really good to see them, sort of the Starks, kind of fall into formation as well. That actually was incredibly neatly satisfying to watch, and I think both Stark girls have both of their storylines. You've kind of just been there going, "Oh God, oh God, you poor thing! Can I rescue you from the TV screen? Come here and have cocoa on my sofa," and to sort of see them finally having had that setup of them both kind of possibly being conflicted.
Although there is that thing, I think the New Yorker show blog said there is that problem that you get when you cast two girls who are supposed to be family members 7 or 8 years ago, and one of them has grown up into a flame-haired kind of Vogue model, and the other one's like about a foot and a half smaller and is quite obviously has no genetic...
Is Jon Snow the only bastard in this setup? This is interesting.
But I like the way that there are some characters there. There are a lot of characters who do not change. You know, like Bronn, always the same.
Yeah.
Littlefinger, always the same, except just like fatally less good at his job later on. And then there's other people that
have to be wrong once, don't you?
Yeah.
but he's still the same guy. Only his accent changes from episode to episode.
What happened to Tommy Carchetti in The Wire? Did he die a miserable end? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Viewers, tweet it.
Is he destined always to his characters to kind of like...
But Sansa has an incredible arc. If you look at her before, this kind of like spoilt and naive and easily manipulated and abused, and sort of growing into, in a very believable way. It's not that suddenly she's become this kind of like superheroine. She's not sort of unstoppable. She's just learned a lot of lessons. And she said that in that episode. It's like, "I've listened to everything that you've taught me."
And I thought,
and I think there's just a handful of characters where you look at them in season one and you look at them now and you think, "Oh, this is proper writing and indeed acting, that evolution."
Incredible casting.
Yeah.
So I interviewed the casting agent a couple of years ago. And I was just mesmerised by how you can choose, because a lot of times you get that wrong. You know, kid actors. I mean, Maisie Williams was, what, 9?
Yeah.
Something like that. It's just mental that they've stuck it out and been so great.
On the Sansa Littlefinger thing, there was a bit of a kind of an outcry. Why did he not die in a more bloody and spectacular and hideous way? And I'm on a Facebook group called Thrones Blurt, on which...
Thrones Blurt.
Full
best
blurt,
name
yeah.
ever.
Erica Jane DuPuy said, "His death is metaphorical of the fact that now all planning, all schemes and all politics are dead. Shit has got real," is the gist of it. So, like, you know, Littlefinger doesn't fit into this world anymore. You can't scheme.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was basically the moral of the story, wasn't it? Pretty much everybody in this episode has realised they've got to put... It doesn't matter what Cersei's policy on healthcare is.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or what Daenerys's policy on housing is.
Just
because
keep breathing.
Absolutely, yeah.
But sometimes I like the way you can just dispose of a character like that. Yeah. There's been so many really dramatic deaths, and I think emotionally one needed to see Ramsay Bolton die in a truly hideous way. But I love the way here it was almost like you were dispatching a kind of like...
It was old.
It was like sacking a pesky employee. It was just like, slash, doom, he's gone. You know, I loved that. And always the fact that everything in Winterfell always looks so sort of... It's a very matter-of-fact, unglamorous place, isn't it?
It was the first real proper Game of Thrones death scene for a while, actually, because everyone, again, when you sell Game of Thrones, it's like, you never know who's going to die. And actually, that's not been true for the past 2 or 3 series, I don't think.
Well, if you're able to see who's going to die, but when the stories are over.
Yeah.
Diana Rigg's story was over. She got a great, I think, pretty great death
great
scene.
Accent.
But, you know, it was never going to happen. Before we move on, to just 2 more things from the finale. Theon, best ever kicked in the balls and not caring scene ever. Theon is finally coming good. And
I like the way they did it as well. Any other kind of fight scene in any other series, that would have happened once, and then he would have grinned and beaten his attacker to death. The fact that the guy did it like 3 or 4 times, and Theon was kind of grinning through his bloody mouth, just absolutely brilliant.
As long-time listener Anita O'Hara says, his talent is he can take a real beating. That's all he's done. His only talent is he can take a thrashing.
But Theon's one of the best characters in there. He's their dark horse. He's their secret weapon. I love Theon.
I just think... I don't care. After like 6 seasons of him being
hosted. As Sansa, I would say.
And then just finally, before we move on to the broader thing, Cersei...
The special thing, as my wife, when we were watching it, pointed out, he's going to go back to rescue his sister, and then he's going to realise that his uncle isn't on the Iron Islands, like he said he was going to, and he's going to alert the armies in the north, who will then be aware that the Golden Hordes are about to pour into
the
south.
Those really fast e-ravens that you just arrive instantly.
Yeah. But he's got a really big... I think that's gonna happen at the
Don't
start of
the next
series.
Don't just send an e-raven, send a first-class e-raven. Yeah. Just before we move on, Cersei in the finale. Now, this was like everything was coming together before Cersei's mania and hatred knocked everything off the board. And like she's effectively, if things proceed in this manner, doomed herself and her people, has she not? Out of her inability to compromise and her, you know, subconscious longing for chaos.
I think it's been telling that the series started off from the ashes of the Mad King.
Yeah.
And over the period of the 6 or 7 seasons, we've seen Cersei become the Mad Queen. So I think it's quite neat the way that's wrapped up. As we've seen, she's just gone nuts. I'd love to know what the conversation was between Tyrion and Cersei. And the real delicious strand for me was, which side is Tyrion now on? Because he did not look too happy about auntie and nephew bumping uglies.
No, he really didn't, did he? So let's move away from talking specifically about the finale and talk about about season 7 of Game of Thrones in general. We talk about the new pace and how some people feel it's going a bit too quickly. So the thing I slightly disliked about it was that events rule the roost rather than character now, which is why I loved so much the yomping around the ice fields bit, because once again we were back to character, and I loved the dragon pit bit, because it was everyone. The show has always been about conflict between individuals and the matrix between everyone you can draw. You know, do we think that you know, when we come back for season 8, or basically season 7 part 2, is it going to be a deluge of events? Are we kind of learn everything we're going to learn about characters now? We're just going to see loads of crazy shit happening every week.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's just a war. We're going to see 6 episodes of a war.
But aren't we going to see things like, you know, Daenerys and Jon are obviously bound to find out what their relationship is. Is Daenerys then going to go, actually, you're the real heir?
I class those as events.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I don't think they're real character developments. They're just, they're kind of bombshells. Like soap opera, kind of like dun dun dun.
On that bombshell. Yeah. Yes.
Because my theory on a soap opera bombshell is Cersei actually pregnant? Or is it just a sort of next stage in arch manipulation?
So somebody pointed out that we might actually see her give birth to a Tyrion shaped Lannister, to a small dwarf.
A Tyrion shaped. That would be a certain poetic justice.
Which would be, completely mad.
And then if she dies in childbirth, like her own mother.
Mm.
There's lots of ways this could go. But
well, she's been told that she can be killed by one of her children, so maybe it's this child. Maggie the Frog, best ever character, told her.
God, yeah. I mean, we've got sort of... I wondered whether there was something to read into the fact that basically everybody is now wearing battle black. There's only one side now. It used to be everybody wore different clothes. All different.
The wardrobe in this series is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Everybody just looks great.
It's very avant-garde. I mean, I actually mentioned the Antwerp Six earlier when we were talking about Cersei, and it's just like, everyone looks like they've been kitted out by a Belgian fashion designer from the 80s.
I don't know who's doing the clothes.
It's a woman called... Oh, my goodness.
No, but in the world of the...
In the oh, who
oh, the world
the,
of
the
show.
The seamstresses
and it's just like,
King's
Daenerys just pops up with this kind of astonishing kind of winter wear dragon riding outfit.
Yeah.
Seemingly from nowhere. Yeah.
They look like medieval Ladytron. They look amazing. Super disciplined military kind of thing.
I tried to pick up the mountain's armour, and three of us could not pick it up. It is so heavy.
The actual armoury
strapped
into...
Yeah.
That's why it looks so glum in there.
It
moves very slowly.
Probably getting a bit ripe in there by now as well, I would have thought. I was amused by the quick meme that went around saying, hey, everybody, let's go and find a zombie to show to Cersei. And like, hang on, there's one standing behind you, darling. There it is. And can't you smell him?
I quite enjoyed Qyburn's kind of like, wow, I could do with some of these. Picking up the hand.
It was like a kind of like tech genius checking out rival companies. Yeah. Like,
look what they can do.
Another interesting point from the world of the internet was top DJ Tim Sheridan pointing out that dragons are more interesting as a metaphor for decisive weapons than as an actual decisive weapon in its own right. You know, more interesting if they're standing there, they're in the background as the kind of threat, the nuclear threat
of dragons,
than actually... But then they are the biggest Chekhov gun in the world, aren't they? They are the Chekhov dragon. You can't have a dragon until, you know, there's no point writing a dragon into a series until you're going to see a bunch of people immolated by its dragon's breath.
I actually thought the wall was a bigger Chekhov's gun. As Jamie was saying earlier, you can't have that massive wall and not see it fall. But, you know, I do take your point about the kind of nuclear
deterrent. Wonder, though, that now the wall has fallen, and I must admit, I thought the big spectacle they'd be holding back for the very end would be dragons versus Army of the Dead.
Yeah.
They've done that, or a version of that. The wall's fallen, and it's like, I don't know how fast they move. I've never really understood the whole logistics of the Army of the Dead on the march. But they go through the wall, and then I don't know how far from the wall to Winterfell or whatever. But I just, considering how hard they are to beat, and how, like, you know, the wildlings were tearing through kind of citizens of the north with their little kind of campfires and little their chickens or whatever, it's like, I really don't know how they're going to kind of handle the kind of tempo of the next bit, because if you've just got this kind of huge zombie army sweeping through the north, it feels like there's not much room for anything else.
Well, I think the defenders are going north, are going to keep going up, are going to meet them halfway.
But that's what I mean. It has to get to like a couple, but you can't just have like six episodes of zombie battles.
It's just going to be, I think it is, you know, you mentioned about, you thought the final scene was going to be the dragons versus the undead. That's the Song of Ice and Fire. I think that's the last episode.
We've been given a few more Jekyll's guns on the table. Firstly, the little throwaway line that, oh, well, you kill the Night King, they'll all die, because that's, you know, that he turned them all.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to use this scorpion ballista on a dragon eventually. I mean, it's Mr. Dragon, and I'm betting on that's going to take out the Ice Dragon. Somehow, with a bit of Kyber magic, whatever.
Well, it doesn't need anything other than just a dragonstone, a dragon glass spear.
Yeah, you see, even this discussion is making me feel like, why am I watching this? Like, kind of, that reminds me of that board game, Crossbows and Catapults. You know, or it suddenly seems like really sort of silly when you're talking about the mechanics of like dragon glass and ice spears and the Night King. And I think I always preferred the threat, like you said, the metaphorical threat of not so much the dragons, of the army of the dead. You know, that this was whatever it was, you know, climate change or, as we've established, Brexit.
Yeah.
You know.
Brexit.
And now they're actually here, and then it's just like huge CGI battles. And I don't know where within that that you're going to be able to find space for like Theon rescuing Yara, which like would be nice, but it's not. Yeah. You can't really compete with that.
I just think we've misunderstood, though. I think that we've been building up to this moment all along. The space is done. We're kind of done with the space. There are just events to happen now. You know, Theon rescuing Yara, I think, is an event.
I think that the secret reveal is at the end, the whole thing is going to turn out to have been in the imagination of a fat bloke with a beard who lives in New York and writes fantasy books. That's going to be the secret reveal.
So elsewhere, and he's got a snow globe with the slogan, "Winter is coming," that was given by his mum. And inside.
And his mum looks like Cersei. You know, in an old black and white picture.
He fancies
And he's got a dwarf brother.
And he's got a dwarf brother, So, a little bit like Battlestar Galactica. So, let's do a quick fire round. Who had a good season? Who had a bad season? Daenerys, Trend to Autocracy. Just starting to talk about insane. Good season, bad season?
Middling?
I'd say good season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't have as much faith in her.
Yeah, she's a bit less interesting now she's actually doing stuff.
I liked it when she was learning to sort of lead.
Yeah.
I really liked it when she was kind of like mucking up local government.
she was the Ted Heath of Westeros.
But now, also, I don't think anybody's been like paid a big enough price for the colossal error of Jon Snow and everyone getting in such a scrape, and then Daenerys coming to rescue them with the dragon, thus giving the Army of the Dead the weapon that they needed, without which they could not break down the wall, and we wouldn't be in this big problem.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of like, and then you're just going, oh, it's nice they're having sex now, and it's like, no. They ruined everything with their stupidity.
But they don't know that dragon exists.
Well, they'd be pretty thick not to think about it, wouldn't they?
Because the undead can't swim.
Hmm, okay.
That's my theory.
That brings us to Jon Snow, good season, bad season, or still as thick as ever he was?
Absolutely as thick as he ever was.
Yeah.
He's not... Yeah, his face sort of always speakers are fine. Like, he's a real just kind of an honest Joe.
And fantastic
in fact,
beasts.
Just be a bit thick. And that's why he speaks as his fines. But also, he doesn't have an imagination.
He's been able to be a bit dense in a lot of different locations this season, so that's quite good. He's done dense in King's Landing, dense on Dragonstone. You know, he's kind of... They've varied him up a bit.
It's like his world tour of not getting it.
Arya. I think Arya became an awful lot less interesting this season until her very last bit with Littlefinger. I thought she'd become rather dull.
Yeah, I think that... She was just a device rather than a character this series.
She's become a kind of mardy teenage assassin, hasn't she?
Well, but you kind of knew that it wasn't really her speaking. You knew that she didn't want to wear those dresses. You knew that she didn't want to be the Lady of Winterfell. So you kind of knew that there was some duplicity going on. So then it just felt, well, you didn't really see anything other than that. She was, I mean, but a lot of the characters probably had four scenes throughout the whole series. You know, so Arya and Sansa and even Littlefinger and Varys and all these great kind of second or B-list characters only had kind of three or four scenes in which to kind of do their stuff. And so I just felt a bit, I don't think we ever saw Arya at all this series.
You don't see an awful lot of Cersei, really. She does significant things, but not many of them. Yeah. You know.
I did like Arya's bag of faces that she keeps under her bed.
like a smelly PE kit. Yeah.
It is basically her PE kit, isn't it?
I thought it was going to be like, oh, because so much is just explained by, oh, magic.
Yeah.
So how'd she change her face? I don't know, magic. No, it's a bag of faces under the bed.
It's like some kind of Ed Gein kind of like.
How did she gain a foot in height? Yeah, that was
the magic thing. I think it's just like Roger Delgado's Master, isn't it, with a very rubbery face, and people go, I had no idea that wasn't you.
Or Miss Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Buffalo Bill from a...
Yeah. My favourite character this season by mile has been the Hound. Who has really like come into his own from total bastard to likable guy, the Peter Hook of North of the Wall, schlepping around, calling everybody a cunt and everything. I loved him.
Best scene out of the whole series for me was him and Brienne in the finale, kind of acting like a proud divorced parents.
Yeah,
over Arya. It was a great moment. Yeah. Loved it.
Tormund's going to be annoyed about that, isn't he? The Hound and And right, just before we wrap it up, then favourite bits of the season. Mine was the ice yomping. Dorian, favourite bit of this season.
I suppose. There were just so many battles, weren't there? Yeah. Normally you get a battle in the penultimate episode, it's all leading up to that, and they were just like battles, battles, battles. I don't know. I mean, I suppose unleashing the dragons. Yes, that bit where you could hear the Dothraki, and they could hear them, and it was like Zulu, without the or maybe with a different version of the problematic racial politics of that film. And they zoomed in on the fear of one of Jaime's soldiers. And it was one of those things where you were just like, you got the sense of the human, like the terror of war. And you got that from, what's his name? Rickon?
Yeah.
Tarly as well, going, I didn't think war was going to be this bad. And just, but that moment where you can hear and you just know it's going to be awful. Yeah. And even though it's technically the goodies coming to beat the baddies, you feel bad for everybody involved because it's just horror. And it's also like weapons of mass destruction. And I think that was it. I always think the best violence in Game of Thrones is one which kind of, you know, you enjoy the spectacle, but you also feel slightly sickened by it.
And a favourite bit?
I think it's been all of Cersei's scenes, actually. I think she's become so... There's also a way that Lena Headey has a speaking that very much reminds me of Glenn Close in Dangerous Liaisons. So part of me is expecting her to sort of drop a glove at some point and go, OK, war. And but I think she's been really magnetic to watch, and I've enjoyed seeing how far ahead that she's become as a strategist as well, having basically been a complete chaos beforehand.
Well, they've killed some of the best actors. That's the problem. Yeah. And so Lena Headey is one of the few remaining genuinely magnetic actors on the show.
Jamie, favourite moments?
Two quickest. Waking up the dragon, Night King waking up the dragon. That was a great moment. Secondly, was Cersei's expression when the undead leapt from that box. The first time in the whole series that she's looked scared.
Fantastic.
Genuine emotion.
Yeah.
You've become a bit. I've become a bit inured to the massive battle scenes where everybody gets eviscerated in really close-up detail. The bit where Samwell Tarly was peeling the grayscale off Jorah Mormont
and cutting into
the pus, just that was like so. That was my one moment where I had to look away this series.
Pudding, if you're rice pudding.
Yeah.
Okay, right. We'll find out what happens in due course. Obviously, in the meantime. Let's get back to now. LCD Sound System split up in quite theatrical fashion in 2011. Having made quite a creditable job of the whole soundtrack to a generation thing, James Murphy made all his doubts public, even made a farewell movie, and then sold all of his kit. He was even filmed weeping in his empty garage about his lost dreams and so forth. 6 years later, he's back with American Dream. What's it like? Is it good? And where does it fit in? We'll find out after this from the album. This is Call the Police. LCD Sound System with Call the Police from the new album American Dream. All very Brian Eno and Lodger meets U2. Anna Fielding, you were a young raver in the heady days of the mid-noughties. Were LCD Sound System a big thing for you?
They're a huge, huge thing for me. I think, a DFA as a whole, as a record label, formed quite a large part of my nights out and my record collection at that point. It's a sound that definitely makes me feel about 26. It's kind of like some Proustian rush on some of that LCD Sound System album. Because although it's moved on and it's got slower, there's still very clear kind of James Murphy hallmarks. And I think whatever you say about LCD Sound System being a band, they are always really James Murphy. And he's a very strange man, I think. I've never met him or anything like that, so I might be terrible slander. But I think also as well, I get the idea that because he's such a record nerd and such a perfectionist, that he doesn't really rank himself amongst his contemporaries anymore. I think he sort of lives in this kind of New York of the mind, where every kind of good bit of music that ever happened in New York is going on. So I think he ranks himself against Talking Heads doing Remain in Light and, you know, early disco and things like that. He wants to be Larry Levan and David Byrne and all these. Those are the people I think he genuinely sees as his contemporaries.
What did you make of this album?
I really enjoyed it, actually. I think he's always been quite preoccupied with ageing as well. I'm currently becoming quite preoccupied with ageing as well.
Come back when you're going, me and Matt, and then we'll discuss it, you know.
I don't know.
You won't be here, mate.
No, precisely, if we can still walk.
Yeah.
It's also quite dreamy, and I know that's part of the title, but he's also, I think, taken a lot of... Although what I said about him living in a kind of fantasy music New York, I think he's taken quite a lot of particularly vocal inspiration from sort of indie bands of the last sort of 5 or 6 years, people like The Drums, and his vocal style for me has changed quite a bit. It seems more relaxed and more, forgive me for using this word, like some of the chill wave bands.
Anna is crossing herself in the studio
there. Never say the C word. So, enjoyable. I think it's a slow burn as well. I think it's a good one for headphones and it's a good one for repeat listening. I think I've enjoyed it. I think when I was listening to it in just a room on my own, I kept kind of pottering off and doing the housework. When I listened to it on headphones, I gave it, just even walking around, I gave it much more attention. I think it's got quite a lot of subtlety to it and it's going to reveal more over time.
Dorian, what did you make of it? This is kind of your wheelhouse, isn't it?
Well, Sound of Silver was my favourite album of that decade.
Yeah.
I mean, they're one of my favourite bands ever. In as much as they're a band.
Yeah.
And what Anna said about being preoccupied with ageing, I thought it was an amazing thing that, and you find this reading Meet Me in the Bathroom, this oral history of New York at that time. You know, the Strokes were young and they were kind of sexy and they really did like epitomize youth. And the fact that he comes out with his first single looking really kind of scruffy and talking about how he's not young.
Yeah.
I thought was amazing, and it seemed like such an eccentric single to start a career with. And then the fact that he could kind of build on that and reveal more and more emotion. And I think this is like, if you liked Someone Great or All My Friends or I Can Change more than the kind of big long dance jams, and I mean, I like them all, but it's that side which informs this. And it's sort of heavy. I was hearing more like Joy Division and The Cure.
There was definitely a kind of post new wave Brit. Yeah. Indie stuff going on.
There's
a
kind of, and some of the lines, man.
There's some very funny lines as well. You're still a pushover for passionate people. I can't even say it.
But some of the lyrics, you know, the future's a nightmare and there's nothing anyone can do about this. I'm not dangerous now the way I used to be once. You've got numbers on your phone of the dead that you can't delete. And it's like,
that's a great line.
Yeah. There are very funny lines as well about deleting email trails and like creating.
That's not funny. That's about like, David Bowie dying.
I thought it was funny. It's not purely
about David Bowie
you
dying.
You sick bastard.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't take it that way.
Ziggy Stardust is dead. Big laugh.
I didn't take it that way. There's a lot of stuff about editing pictures of versions of yourself that aren't there anymore because you're trying to present the version. Basically, a large part of this album to me was like, if that Arcade Fire album about modern digital culture had been a bit cleverer and a bit funnier and with a bit better tunes, it would be like this.
Oh, I didn't get that from it at all. I think I just got this enormous sense of kind of loss. And he's always very, very good. There's very few songwriters that are brilliant at depicting the age at which they are. So you as a fan, whether you are exactly the same age as them or not, it feels like each record they release, you can sort of identify. And he's a few years older than me, so it's kind of like he's like the advance party.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff that I find incredibly... incredibly poignant.
Maybe that's why I find it funny, because he's a few years younger than me. I'm just like, you don't know anything yet. You know nothing. Jamie, what did you make of it? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, I've not looked into it as deeply as my fellow podcasters, but I, on the few times I did listen to it, because it's bloody streaming, Mm-hmm. Download the sodding thing.
Yes.
I just enjoyed it for the tunes. It was kind of, I thought it was a great opener. He sounds less like Kermit the Frog now, which I thought was a good thing.
Yeah. But he's definitely got the David Bowie Lodger voice. I'm not happy David Bowie is dead, actually, Dorian. Not happy at all. Not happy remotely. I think he's got the David Bowie Lodger voice and Mark Eastmore's voice.
Yeah.
No, so, you're living that in.
No. So I don't know, for whatever reason, they completely kind of passed me by until they'd split up. I can't remember, dark days back then.
You were busy libeling people on the internet.
I was busy libeling people on the internet. So I kind of got into them in between then. But everyone, he's just a cool guy. He's a funkier version of Guy Garvey, if that makes sense. They wear the same shirts.
Probably the same size shirts, yeah. I should imagine. Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. It was good fun.
But he's cool, but he also is so hyper-aware always of like the failings of cool. And that not being enough.
Yeah. Which in itself makes you look even cooler.
But he still loves it, doesn't he? It's like a sort of love-hate relationship with cool, I think, that he's always had. It's kind of it's the one side he has this immense amount of knowledge that should make him cool. And on the other side, he's quite, as you say, very aware of, do you even want that? But he really does. Yeah.
But they are
cool,
though, aren't they?
I think it's always hard to find records that just speak to your life and actually tell you something useful.
OK, we've got to wrap it up here. And we're coming to the end of the show, which means it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests tell us what's been obsessing them this week, lightening their life or driving them up the wall. Anna Fielding of Stardust Magazine, what's your Closing Time Chatter?
I've picked a graphic novel by illustrator and writer called Joff Winterheart, which is an amazingly Game of Thrones
name, actually, isn't it? Of House Winterheart, yes.
It's a very non-graphic Game of Thrones graphic novel. It's called Driving Short Distances. It's about a young lad in his late 20s who returns home to his hometown after a bit of a breakdown and gets this weird job with kind of a much older man who says he's some kind of second cousin. But it's basically a study in how men talk to each other or don't talk to each other. And, you know, you'll see the other guy's friends go past and they'll be described as Alan Pritchard owns the second finest gravel merchants in this town, or Dick Wenlock's development and security keeps a fine selection of tropical fish, and he describes them as key janglers and tire kickers and miniature memorabilists, and he says they've always become like celebrities to me. But it's this wonderful study of a particular kind of man, probably even around his early 60s. It's got so much tenderness, though. It's funny and it's well observed. But like his Joff Winterheart's previous one, which was Days of the Bagnall Summer, which actually won a lot of prizes a few years back, it's incredibly sensitive as well. It says
what's
a lot
it called?
It's called Driving Short Distances.
Okay, fantastic. Dorian Linsky, what have you got for us?
I just finished a book called Exit Right by a historian called Daniel Oppenheimer, I think. And it's case studies of half a dozen people who started off on the left, either as sort of liberals or actual communists, and ended up being major figures on the American right.
So people who were left-wing and then they became part of the soft right. People like that.
Yes.
People that happened to. That's interesting.
But many of them went quite hard right. So you've got your David Horowitz, Christopher Hitchens, Whittaker Chambers, Ronald Reagan. And it's just a fascinating insight into why people change their politics. This old kind of rather glib thing about, oh, people move from the left to the right as they get older because they've got more money and they don't want to pay taxes, or they just become more conservative. It's like in each case here, there is a moment, whether it is a kind of a major sort of betrayal or a breakdown or a kind of weird religious epiphany stroke manic episode. There's so many complicated factors, and you realize actually how much people's political beliefs, which they'd like to present as very intellectual and thought about, are just come from these very deep personal, psychological, emotional reasons. And I just found it incredible. I think you can apply it to quite a lot of other people who have made that journey.
Fantastic. And that's Exit Right by
Daniel Oppenheimer.
Daniel Oppenheimer. Amazing. Jamie, Closing Time Chatter.
I've just been on my own quite a lot, Andrew, and I found it very strange. I don't know if anyone's...
Why is this?
Well, my family went on holiday.
Without you?
Without me, which I kind of actively encouraged, almost forced them away. But then found myself within hours with a Dremel in my hand just carving wood out of boredom. And I advise anyone to... Does anyone else have a Dremel?
I don't even know what a Dremel is.
Yeah,
is this another Game of Thrones character?
Oh, mate, you've not lived until you've... A Dremel is like a mini drill that has all these amazing attachments. For gadget lovers, it's incredible.
Okay.
But you find yourself... I just found myself making a sign for my house.
So this was, you basically
I was
did
so lonely and bored.
You basically did an Alan Partridge disassemble the trouser, Corby trouser press thing.
If they hadn't arrived back on Sunday, I'd be in Dundee without any shoes on, mate.
There you go. Matt, have your closing time chatter for us.
So the Great British Bake Off started this week, and I've never seen it before, but I watched it, but I got bored after about 10 minutes, so started looking what people were saying on Twitter, and there was this brilliant, kind of slightly weird situation going on where the Yorkshire Tea official Twitter feed was slagging off the Dr. Oetker official Twitter feed for the amount of money that they must have spent on sponsoring the show. And then the Lurpak Twitter official Twitter feed got involved, and he just had all these very was it Meta? I don't know.
It's probably the same guy.
It may well be. It'll be an agency. Yeah, of course.
Media version of football mascots fighting, isn't it?
It was exactly that.
So, this does happen on certain message boards and certain kind of threads where people start arguments with themselves, but with their different persona. But I quite like the idea that of these brands going rogue and having a kind
of... It was a lot more interesting than the programme.
I think it's like Bran. There's just like this guy, the three-eyed maven, and he just sits there.
So three-eyed maven.
With like all of these kind of laptops doing all of the brands and talking to each other.
So ultimately, it's basically one person is doing all social media. It's a gigantic conversation with itself.
Exactly.
Bill Hicks.
That's basically the size of it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, my closing time chat is just a quick one. I am not behind Taylor Swift's bullshit buy my merchandise in order to get a shot at buying tickets for my shows thing. This is the most disgraceful exploitation of any pop fans I've ever seen. And usually I'm quite in favour of exploiting pop fans. Somebody's got to pay for the record companies and paying the journalists and that kind of thing. But to say to people that in order to get a chance to buy a concert ticket, you've got to buy her album on some kind of overpriced fast delivery thing, and you'll get more points if you listen to the song
often. Is it a Nectar card for pop stars?
It is basically the Nectar card. But on the Nectar card, your points don't expire within a few days, so you've got to rack them up again. It's more like some kind of bad video game where you've got to keep eating the mushrooms to keep your health up, all to push Taylor Swift.
That doesn't work, by the way, kids.
No, well, I'm sure it doesn't. Depends what mushrooms they are. Just purely in the service of Taylor Swift's social media footprint.
Wow.
She's basically outsourced her social media promotion to her fans so that they can have not a ticket, but the chance to buy a ticket. It's disgraceful. Stop it.
Well, if she doesn't have a banger for the second single, none of it will matter anyway.
It won't, yeah. And actually, Taylor Swift, brace yourself for think pieces. Anyway, there we go. That's another show. Thank you to Dorian Linsky. Thank you to Anna Fielding. And thank you to Jamie East for joining us. Let's do it again when Game of Thrones comes around next time in 2025 or whenever that may be. Listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts, as well as finding us on Spotify. And you can follow us on Twitter at big_mouthuk. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week. Bye.